This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. 7 years ago, a heat wave began in Chicago. It started on July 13, 1995. The temperature hit 106 degrees. The heat index was 126. The heat was relentless. When it broke a week later, more than 700 people were dead. Fewer than half that number had died in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. How could so many people die from a weather-related event in a major American city at the end of the 20th century? We look into that question today on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. He's the author of Heat Wave, a social autopsy of disaster in Chicago. In this social autopsy, Kleinenberg remembers the dead, tells us why they died, and says it could happen again. Eric Kleinenberg teaches at Northwestern University. This fall, he will be an assistant professor of sociology at New York University. His book, Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, is published by the University of Chicago Press. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Eric Kleinenberg. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Eric Kleinenberg joins us this afternoon from Northwestern University, and I want to thank Northwestern for the high-quality phone line we're going to enjoy here this afternoon. Eric Kleinenberg, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. You're a native of Chicago, but you were away from the city in Europe during the heat wave of 95, and you read about it in the newspaper. What were your first impressions of the disaster?
Well, it was a surprise for me. I was living in my cousin's sixth-floor walk-up apartment, no elevator, no air conditioning, in Paris, suffering from a bit of a heat wave myself, but not really reading reports of mortality around Europe, a couple scattered deaths here and there, nothing eye-popping. And one morning, over a morning survey of the newspaper, I came across this story of death in Chicago and had a hard time understanding how something like this could have happened. There was a photograph of 8 or 9 refrigerated meatpacking trucks in the center of the city at the morgue. Apparently, the medical examiner's office had been so overwhelmed by the mortality, they had to bring in these trucks to manage the load, and it seemed, you know, somewhat difficult to account for. So I came to Chicago a few weeks later just to see my family and friends with a real sense of puzzlement, a sense that this was a great mystery, and I wanted to know what had happened. I felt somewhat unsatisfied by the journalistic reporting I had read, and so I started to ask them, and kind of lo and behold, I found yet another mystery, which is a real sense of detachment on the part of the people who had just experienced this trauma. There were questions about whether the deaths were themselves really real. That was the phrase that recurred at the time. Question of whether the deaths really happened or whether they were actually related to the heat or were they just coincidental. A very strange way of talking about an event in which everyone in the world could see the bodies right in the center of the city. And so at that point, I was about to start a graduate program in sociology, and I started asking around and decided that I was going to spend the next several years pursuing these questions, following it up, and doing what I came to consider a social autopsy to make sense of the social and cultural and political causes of deaths that until now have largely been attributed to forces of nature.
Mm. Is this something that sociologists have done, take a look at a disaster from, you know, the perspective of that discipline?
It is. There are a few different strains of literature that proved to be very useful for me. There's a fairly rich sociology of disasters. Books like Kai Erickson's Everything in Its Path. Diane Vaughan wrote a terrific book about the Challenger disaster that helped us explain organizationally why systems broke down. What I did is draw upon the equally, if not greater, literature from the University of Chicago and the kind of famous Chicago School of Sociology to look at how the city itself broke down during an event like this. And the kind of metaphor I began using is to say that if the conventional medical autopsy takes its course with a medical examiner opening up the body and searching for the physical organs that broke down, my task in a way was to kind of take the city as the object of analysis and to open it up and look at the social and political organs that made the disaster so much worse than it might otherwise have been. So to answer your question, yes, there were some precedents for it, but it required me working around in a few different fields.
You mentioned how the coroner's office was overwhelmed. So too were hospitals. Maybe you would remind us of some of the things that happened during the heat wave.
Well, it was a disaster that many people had trouble anticipating. As you'll remember, the 1990s were a kind of boom time in Chicago and in cities like it. We spent a lot of time talking about the renaissance of the city, the ways in which we had overcome many of the problems that had beset urban centers for decades. And I think most people were focusing on things other than problems of deprivation or poverty or isolation in cities. And so when the death reports came from the police department, from the medical examiner, I think many people in Chicago were initially shocked to hear the news. The paramedics were absolutely overwhelmed. They were on the front lines responding to calls for cases of morbidity, heat-related illnesses. There were thousands during the week. And many of the paramedics claim that they made special requests to the higher-ups in their department. The fire department in Chicago administers the paramedics work. And they requested additional services. They wanted backup ambulances. They wanted additional staff. Chicago has 59 ambulances working regularly, and they wanted to call in private vehicles or vehicles from the suburbs. And they report that the higher-ups in the department denied those requests. Similarly, the police department in the city never generated the activity on the part of its senior units, part of its community policing program, to reach out to people who are old and vulnerable and at home. So there was a sense in which many people in the city were not quite prepared for the event that was about to unfold. The hospitals themselves were more than overwhelmed. There's a condition called bypass in Chicago hospitals. Hospitals can go on bypass status, whereby they close their doors and refuse to take in new patients to the emergency rooms when they feel like they can't handle any more patients. At one point during this week, 23 of the city's hospitals were on bypass status, and 18 were on bypass status at the same time, leaving the paramedics that could get to people in need driving around sometimes for miles looking for a place where people could get care. So in a way, the city was culturally, politically not quite ready to handle this kind of event. In fact, it took a series of media reports from journalists in the city, as well as a series of urgent calls from the medical examiner, to get everyone on board to recognize that this was a real and legitimate disaster in the making. Because, as I explained in the book, for many people in Chicago, the immediate response was to deny that it was happening at all, to say that there's no way this is real.
At the time, there was speculation that the heat killed people whose deaths were imminent, and this is the question you call the really real question. And you say it's a question that's debated to this day. How do you answer that question?
Well, there's a few different components of the really real question. The first was the question of whether the deaths were related to the heat, because when Ed Donahue, the county medical examiner, began announcing that there were heat-related deaths, Mayor Daley and many other city officials questioned the scientific criteria of his autopsies. So he had to convince people in the political field that his science was proper. The political skepticism in turn generated a kind of journalistic skepticism, and there were a whole series of articles about this controversy, even when in fact the scientific controversy was settled very quickly. In fact, what we now know is that there were 521 cases of heat-related deaths in which the medical examiner did an autopsy or had a police investigation on a specific case. That's for the month of July of 1995. But public health researchers have what they think is a more sophisticated way of understanding heat-related mortality, and that's to look at the excess deaths during a given period of time. The reasoning is the following. When you have a massive outbreak of death like we had in Chicago 7 years ago, many bodies will be buried before there's time to do an autopsy. Someone might not recognize that there's a need. In fact, most people who die are never autopsied. And so hundreds of bodies, they speculated, might have been buried before they could do any science on them. And The excess death figure is calculated by looking at the typical death rate for a week. In a typical day of July in Chicago, about 72 people die, so about 500 would die in a week. And what they found is that for the week of the most intense heat in Chicago, the excess death figure was 739, so 739 people in excess of the norm died that week. That's another element of the really real question. And then the third element of the really real question is the one that you asked. Was it possible that these were people who were just about to die anyway, whose deaths were imminent? And there were a whole series of public health studies done, many by the state of Illinois, in the weeks and months and years following the disaster. And they found that while there was a brief decline immediately after the event, the months and years after showed no real decline. These were not people who were already about to die. They were people whose deaths were hastened. We can take a lesson from just the past few weeks in Chicago. So far, the city has recorded 17 heat-related deaths, and included in those death figures are people in their 30s, their 40s, their 50s. So these are not cases of people who are about to die anyway. And yet, what I found in doing my research is that the political officials' skepticism and the journalistic skepticism that we saw during the week had real resonance with people in Chicago and people outside of Chicago for some reason. It was as if there was a will to deny that this had happened, a will not to know about this kind of incredible underside of human life. And so, although many of the hundreds of people I interviewed, almost all of them, could remember the scene at the morgue with the trucks and could remember even the mass grave that the image for which I used to close the book, there remained this kind of skepticism about whether the event was really real. And I have to say that I think that I've figured out the answers to many of the puzzles that I had when I began the research. But this last question, this puzzle of why is it that there's been such a collective desire to put this event out of sight, to question whether it was really happening, that's one that troubles me to this day. And that's a kind of question that I think is metaphorically useful for thinking collectively about the ways in which we've come to terms with poverty, deprivation, isolation, this issue of aging and living alone in American cities today, because we can now see that, in fact, these issues are part of the everyday life of cities like Chicago and places elsewhere, and yet we have very little capacity to take them seriously, very little interest in talking about them collectively, so we go on as if they weren't happening. And more or less, that's my feeling about what's happened to the heat wave.
Yeah. A whole lot of denial going on. In the book, you write about denial quite extensively, and you draw on the work of another sociologist, Stanley Cohen, to look at denial. Maybe you'd give us some idea of the scope of the denial in Chicago in its experience with the heat wave of 95.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I found that Stan Cohen's work from a terrific book called States of Denial was surprisingly and I think disturbingly useful during my analysis of what happened this week. Cohen establishes a kind of typology of various forms of denial. Literal denial, the event didn't happen. We saw that from Mayor Daley at the very beginning of this crisis when Daley argued that we shouldn't blow the event out of proportion and we couldn't count every case of mortality that we witnessed as a form of heat-related death, or else everyone who died in the summer would die a heat-related death. We also saw forms of interpretive denial, forms of silencing, a kind of denial of responsibility, blaming the victim, the classic statements coming from city officials who said, what's really happening here are that the people who died are people who neglected to take care of themselves. It's a problem of individual responsibility. Now, in fact, it turned out that when I did research in the public administrator's office where they investigate cases where someone dies and no one comes to claim the body or the estate, I found many letters and notes written by the victims making it fairly clear that they oftentimes were longing for some kind of social support and attention that they couldn't get. And yet this blaming the victim kind of approach was politically effective. There was also a kind of deflection or denial of responsibility. For example, many people in the city argued that the real culprit was Commonwealth Edison, the utilities provider that had failed to keep power running in the city. In fact, the generators on the northwest side of the city failed, and almost 50,000 people lost power, some for as long as 2 days, in the midst of this heat. Did Commonwealth Edison cause the deaths? Well, according to many of the people, they were major culprits in this. And then I talk about another kind of denial I think of as euphemism or renaming. Here, for example, the clearest case is that after the event, the mayor called together a commission of experts from Chicago who would report on why so many people had died in the city and try to look for ways that the city could improve its policy response. And when they published their findings, the title of the report was The Mayor's Commission on Extreme Weather Conditions. And it was published with a snowflake as well as the sun on the cover. I have a photograph in it in a book. And it's, in my view, a way of hiding the report while showing it, if you will. A kind of way of making a euphemism for this kind of terrible thing that happened, renaming it an extreme weather condition to deflect our attention away from it, renaming it. And finally, there was a way of denying the event that Cohen would call isolating. You take the event outside of its context, outside of its history. In fact, in the United States, this is something that very few people know, more people die in heat waves than in all other forms of natural disasters combined. There's a great precedent of heat wave deaths, and there's also a lot of literature that shows us what the risk factors for heat-related deaths are. And yet, there was a way in which Chicago officials talked about it that made it sound as if the event was totally unprecedented, isolated, and unlike anything else. And while, of course, this was an extreme heat wave, and of course the death rate was much higher than we've seen in other events, the city was prepared to handle something like this. In fact, it had a heat plan. And so it seemed to me like each one of these forms of denial helped to push the heat wave story in another direction and in some way blocked our collective capacity to come to terms with the event. And so there are a few chapters in the book on the politics of this disaster, and one of the chapters is entitled Governing by Public Relations. And this is the chapter in which I lay this out and try to make the argument that while on the one hand we need government public relations to make us aware of the kinds of programs and policies that are there to help us or that are available to us as citizens, at the same time, public relations can be incredibly damaging if it's used to block the flow of information inside both the body politic and also inside of a government structure. I introduced the possibility that the delayed response to this event from the fire department and paramedics, from the police department, from the health department, from various other city agencies might have been at least partially attributed to the city's own refusal to acknowledge what was happening in its midst, to make public, even to people inside of the city, the extent of this disaster. And there were definitely city officials who reported to me that they were explicitly instructed not to go public with the death figures that they saw as the event was unfolding. So there's some very tricky and I think very serious issues that we need to pay attention to in the governance of these matters.
Yeah.
But I also just want to say at the same time, before I push too hard on this, that I think it would be a big mistake to come away from the book with the lesson that this is the fault of the government, that the city caused it, because of course the city government is not responsible on its own in the same way that Commonwealth Edison is clearly not responsible on its own. My argument is that what we have here is an event in which literally hundreds of people died alone and at home, behind sealed windows, behind locked doors, out of contact with friends, with families, with community organizations, with social providers, generally unreported by media for much of their lives. And that can only happen when there's a collective social breakdown, a real breakdown in which all of us are implicated. And so the book intends for all of us to kind of take up this issue and to be an invitation for us to consider the ways that we live and that we die in cities today. Because the easiest thing that could come of this is that we would point a finger and say, see, that's someone else's fault. We have nothing to do with this. The truth is that this was a great event, really one of the definitive moments in modern American history, 700 people dying in a major city during its period of great opulence. And we all bear some responsibility for that, in my view, and it's worth pursuing these questions collectively.
Yeah. In the prologue of the book, you say, collectively, we've created the conditions that made the situation so deadly. And you also say we can unmake them. I wonder, have we made any progress in the past 7 years toward unmaking those deadly conditions, those social fault lines?
It's a good question. At the most basic level, I should be clear that the city of Chicago has developed and implemented one of the most effective heat emergency plans in the United States today. And by many accounts, including researchers from the Midwestern Climate Center, the city's response saved many lives in the 1999 heat wave in Chicago, which was comparable meteorologically in many respects. Still, 110 people died in 1999 in a heat wave in Chicago that's received even less public attention than the one in 1995, and that's really saying something. So I think more cynically that the underlying conditions that make us so vulnerable to heat emergencies, to these exogenous forces that we can't control, are still with us today. There are hundreds of thousands of seniors living on their own, many in poverty. Chicago itself has 110,000 seniors living alone, 15 or 16% of whom at least are living in poverty. And they live in a kind of emergency in slow motion often, one that we don't recognize because there's nothing dramatic about it. It's out of our sight lines and it's out of our minds. And that creates a kind of everyday insecurity that we could be more aware of, that we could be dealing with. I should also say that cities like Chicago continue to have serious crises in affordable housing, particularly for the elderly and people on fixed incomes. We continue to have neighborhoods that were left out of the great economic boom of the last 10 years, places that look much like they did 20 years ago, and yet have disappeared from our vocabulary in this era in which we seem to believe that we've transcended the problems of poverty. We also have a kind of everyday energy crisis throughout the city, particularly in extreme summer and winter months. There are times when the elderly and people living on fixed incomes are spending about one-third of their monthly income on energy costs, and to prepare for that are keeping their lights off during the day, doing everything that they can to make ends meet. And I think these conditions require some serious critical attention from us, and yet we're for some reason reluctant to do that. And so in part I have to say it's my hope that a story as dramatic and compelling as this heat wave in Chicago could serve as a kind of invitation to look again at these kinds of conditions that I think we have created together. My hope is that the kinds of people who might be bored by an abstract analytic paper on the poverty or on urban social problems might be drawn into what's really a great kind of mystery story about this perplexing week in the life of Chicago. And in the process of retelling the story, I think I try to convey some sense of the urban condition that we've made today.
You do a very good job of it. Eric Kleinenberg is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, a sociologist. He's the author of Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a listener ready to talk with us this afternoon on the toll-free line in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. A very interesting discussion. Several short questions, please. You said the number killed in the 95 heat wave in Chicago was 700?
There are a few different numbers that we can use. There's the excess death number. That's the blip in the mortality rate, where you take a typical death rate for a week in July in Chicago, and then you look at the number of deaths above that. And according to the American Journal of Public Health and the chief epidemiologist from the city of Chicago at the time, that number is 739.
Oh my gosh.
You can also do a heat-related death measure in which you need to have an autopsy of the body or a police investigation. And as I explained, because many bodies are never autopsied, most public health experts think that drastically undercounts the heat-related death toll in many cases. For the month of July in 1995, their number is 521. Mm-hmm. It's disturbing, but I have, unfortunately, news that's even more disturbing, which is that in the year of 1995, when there were so many hundreds of people who died in this condition, the public administrator's office in Chicago that typically investigates cases where no one comes to claim a body did a total of about 1,100 investigations. In other words, they looked into the deaths of 1,100 people who were never claimed. In 1998, that number was around 1,400. And in 1999, that number was around 1,600. So if 95 was an anomaly in recent history, it's to the extent in which it was a low count relative to other times. So these are things we need to look at.
And I've been listening to you on and off. I had to run an errand, go uptown and come back. And I thought I heard you say that heat-related deaths account for more than the total number and all the rest of natural catastrophes in this country. Is that right?
That's right. Earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, and floods combined kill far fewer people than heat waves in the United States. And yet, in a way, it's an invisible public health issue and has been for a long time, in my view, in part because heat waves typically fail to generate the spectacular and camera-ready images that make those other disasters front-page news. Mm-hmm. They also tend to kill the old, the poor, the isolated, the sick, the people from whom we typically turn away during our ordinary lives, and it's perhaps should not be a surprise that we turn away from them when they die during these catastrophes as well.
I realize, just a very final last question, I realize generalizations can be stretched, but it seems as if you're saying the profile of those killed were the poor elderly living alone. Would that be somewhat accurate?
They were the most likely to die. And yet, I'd like to be clear about this. More than a quarter of the 700-some deaths took place among people who are under 65.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have a quarter of 700, that's a big number.
It's about 175, isn't it? Or
something like that.
Yeah.
And so, the point is that I think it's a disturbing story.
Yeah.
And one that we shouldn't kind of dismiss for any
yes,
set of reasons.
Yes.
Like I said, the number of people who are living alone on a daily basis continues to grow.
I want to thank that listener for his call this afternoon, and I'm going to go on now to another caller calling us toll-free from Aurora on line 2. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to make this point, and I think it's wonderful that you are making the statement you are about heat and that being a disaster. I'll briefly say that I had a niece that lived in an apartment. And I know cross ventilation in apartments is very, very important, and you don't get cross ventilation. They say you don't even have a window in your bathroom anymore. And I think all those building things that they allow these days. Well, anyway, this niece lived in this apartment, and it was stifling. There was only windows on one side of the apartment. But what she did was she asked her neighbor to open up her door, and she opened up her door, and then they had cross-ventilation. But what if she didn't have a neighbor that was friendly? She would never have cross-ventilation. And that's how they were able to get their apartment to cool off to some extent. So I think the housing is also a problem in this situation. Thank you.
The caller makes an interesting point. Unfortunately, when it gets dangerously hot, even a fan and cross ventilation does nothing other than recirculate the hot air. People really need air conditioning, and if they can't get air conditioning, they need frequent baths and showers and treatments with water to stay cool. The people who died tended to be people who were stuck in apartments that didn't have air conditioning. I could also say that many of the people who died were clustered in neighborhoods that had high levels of violent crime and homicide. In fact, statistically, when you do an analysis, you find that there's a relationship between living in a neighborhood with a high level of violent crime and being exposed to the dangers of heat, having a heat-related death. So in many cases, people are unable to open their windows because they don't have windows on both sides, as your caller says, but also there are oftentimes social conditions that prevent people from wanting to open their homes in any way, which is why several of the people who died were found with their windows literally sealed shut and the doors locked.
Yeah. One of the heartbreaking aspects of this story is the isolation in the city. So many people died alone. How many people died alone?
Well, unfortunately, that's impossible to really know. There are no police records. There are no medical investigations that show whether a decedent is found alone. There are a couple ways in which you can approximate it. The public administrator's office records give me part of that. Sometimes the administrators leave notes describing the condition in which the body was found, and oftentimes they'll say whether someone else was there. It's also important to note that when I went to the public administrator's office 5 years after the event, I found records of about 160 investigations that they had done during that week. So we know that there were at least 160 people who not only died alone, but also died alone and then had no one come to claim their bodies or their estates immediately. My guess is if there are that many, several hundred of the other deaths also took place alone. And a further reason for believing this is that in most cases, people who are suffering from heat-related illnesses can be kept alive with the most simple kinds of intervention. When they start feeling uncomfortable, they can be given water or treated with ice, put in a cold bathtub. And so what's so tragic and disturbing about these deaths is that they were in so many ways easy to prevent. They were deaths of social deprivation.
Mm. Do we know how many people might have not had water?
Water treatments?
Had their water turned off.
Right, that's the reason I asked you this question, is because one of the issues I report on in the book is that we're now living in a very different kind of political context in which citizens, more than ever, are treated like consumers in a market of public goods rather than citizens who are entitled to public benefits. We have a mode of governance in which we try to manage government agencies like corporations. In Chicago, many of the city agencies are headed by CEOs these days rather than by commissioners. And we have a kind of market model of governance. And in the water department in Chicago, I discovered many people who had stopped paying water bills for whatever reason found that they were treated in the same way that delinquent customers in other businesses are treated. They had their supply cut off. And so when I was doing field work trying to learn about the lives of older people who are alone, I was shocked to start meeting senior citizens who were very poor and were living with no water, had their water shut off. Again, I tell stories about some of them in the book, but it's impossible to know how many people had their water shut off during that week. Another public health issue that Chicago had to face, and that actually has faced up to, is that when there's extreme heat in a city, particularly neighborhoods where there are not a lot of public air-conditioned places, will have lots of kids go out and open fire hydrants to keep cool. There are about 43 fire hydrants in Chicago, and during the heat wave of 95, over 3,000 of them were opened, and that meant that the neighborhoods in some of the areas where there were clusters of hydrants open lost their water pressure for hours. And when the energy went out for certain neighborhoods, the pumps that were used to pump water up to the higher floors of high-rises, including some of the CHA buildings, stopped working. And so there were key times when residents of Chicago didn't have water, but it's impossible to know how many and for how long. And again, I try to end the book by using this as a kind of provocation for us to look more seriously at these things. How many stories are there of this kind of everyday deprivation in the life of the city that we just don't know about because they're never reported? It takes real work to learn about these things, and you're unlikely to get much information about them in the paper that you pick up every day, let alone on the television news stations that you watch. And so how could we come to terms with these things more effectively? How can we learn what's happening around us? Are we really interested?
Yeah. You mentioned government having a private enterprise kind of philosophy these days. This also enters into the picture in terms of the media coverage that we get. Maybe you would talk with us about how that impacted what we learned and how we learned it.
Right. Well, I found that in the research I did inside of newsrooms, and I spent time interviewing a lot of the Chicago reporters and editors who worked on these stories. Many people inside of the news business feel themselves within a kind of bind. On the one hand, they're doing everything they can to keep their readers, their audiences tuned into them. They want people coming back to the newspaper or the television show. And on the other hand, they feel a kind of public responsibility to tell these big stories, do the kind of analytic or explanatory journalism that oftentimes makes them satisfied. And the heat wave posed some real dilemmas for people inside of the newsroom, because it availed them to these spectacular images, the shots of the morgue, these trucks in particular, the police carrying out body bags, the scene I've referred to again, the mass grave at the end of the event. Because I should probably explain this very quickly. After the event, several dozen of the victims who had never been claimed were buried in a 160-foot-long trench in Homewood, a suburb on the south side of Chicago. And the photographs of that event make the suburban cemetery look like Bosnia or El Salvador during the 1980s. It looks completely foreign, and those images are just very disturbing for many people. And journalists inside of these newsrooms had to decide how much they were going to feature those images and how much reporting they would do that was more analytic and more explanatory. And so, unfortunately, what oftentimes happens is that the more spectacular and the more sensational images, the ones that are in many ways easier to get, take precedence over the really tough reporting that city journalists have to do. And so if you review the news television programs or the newspaper stories from the time, you find a preponderance of these shocking images and far less of the kind of penetrating news that you would hope to get. I tell one story in the book that was troublesome for me concerning an important decision at the Chicago Tribune, the kind of flagship paper in Chicago, where an editor decided to honor the request of one of the senior writers and put a whole team of reporters on the job of establishing and developing profiles of the heatwave victims over several weeks. And they sent literally a team of six or seven reporters out getting as much information as they could about more than 100 victims around the city. And they did this terrific reporting and were ready to compile a major investigation. And what happened is that by the time the reporting was done, it was November, and the journalists wanted to put something together, and at some editorial meeting, they collectively made a decision that their readers of the Tribune would just not be interested in an event like this because, in their view, it was a summer story, and since it was November, it was no longer relevant. And what happened in the end is that the paper printed a kind of summary article that had a smattering of these profiles. They were very short. They were not as informative as the reporting could have made them, and it was, you know, more or less buried in the scheme of things. Although some people read it, it never turned out to be the major investigation. And here it seemed that there was a kind of marketing logic based on what the editors thought that their readers would be interested in. And again, this is the kind of story that we see happening every day in city newspapers. I'm doing a new research project in which I'm inside a lot of other newsrooms, and one can tell that the editorial boards are not often charged to do reporting on urban social problems, on poverty, on deprivation, above all other things. They have another agenda that they want to push forward. And so there are many major issues in the city that go uncovered on a daily basis. And in my view, unfortunately, the issues that are left off are often the most consequential for us.
Yeah. Getting back to that image, that photograph that you include in the book of the 41 victims whose bodies were unclaimed and who were buried in a mass grave in August of 1995 in Homewood. The media were there, clergy were there, but just two civilians.
Right, a local historian from Homewood named Elaine Eggdorf and her granddaughter were there, and Elaine provides a terrific firsthand account of what happened at the end of the book. And in fact, her words and her testimony were so powerful that I let them largely speak for themselves and use it to get us all the way towards the end of this story. What I tried to do through the book is to use the voices of people in all places and institutions in the city, whether they were fire officials, police officers, journalists, the seniors who are living alone, the medical examiner, the mayor, people living in single-room occupancy dwellings. I use their stories to animate the book. This is a book, like I said, that tries to open up the city and look at it as a total system. But it's not an abstract sociological study. It's a book of narratives. And my hope is that through these stories, we'll all come to understand the various positions that people occupy in a city as complex as Chicago, and find this event a little more human, recover the kind of human dimension of this story. And that's another reason to do a social autopsy. I make the argument that our two most conventional methods of explaining death, the medical autopsy and the epidemiological report, remove us so far from the human and the social dimensions of death that it makes it sound like a foreign and estranged part of the world that we live in. And so we clearly need some act of understanding, and it's that kind of project that a sociology of the city, that an ethnography of the city can help us to accomplish, and that's a major motivation for doing this social autopsy.
Yeah. Elaine Eggdorf's statement is very moving, and it really puts into perspective for me, as she says in her to quote her, she says, to think you witness all of these things, but when you get to a certain age in life, you think, well, okay, this is life, this is a fact. But then there she is in the cemetery, and it just overwhelms her. She says the chills ran up her spine.
Yeah, I think it was an overwhelming experience for the journalists who were there as well, and I'd like to be able to say for everyone who was there, but as you mentioned, no one came. I went back to the cemetery myself and interviewed the people who manage it, and they told me that they've never had a friend or family member of one of the victims come to see the mass grave. Journalists come occasionally, but for the most part, it remains a story that none of us are much interested in. Yeah. And so, my sense is that part of the reason is that we feel a kind of shame or humiliation about something like this. We have this will not to know about this underside of our lives, and in part because it's so disturbing to really take it on and to claim this as our own that it's hard to do. At the same time, my hope is that when we stop for a moment to have a time to reflect on this thing, 700 people in the city of Chicago in 1995, in the heart of America's famous city of neighborhoods, as we like to call ourselves here in Chicago, we might reconsider the way that we live our lives, the way that we manage these issues. Perhaps we have a kind of humanitarian incentive to make sure that something like this never happens again. And perhaps we recognize that a short-term acute emergency response is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
That's part of my hope. But then also the other invitation is to take this on as I did for so many years as a great mystery, as an incredible puzzle, to try to understand how it's possible for something like this to happen, and I hope that the book is at least a kind of modest contribution towards that endeavor.
Yeah, what kind of reaction is the book getting from I when I was reading it, I was thinking how important it is for people to read this book and how useful it could be for neighborhood activists, people who work for social service agencies, of course, the government and the media. Have you heard? What are you hearing?
Well, the official publication date for the book is July 17th, when we're doing a public talk at the Harold Washington Library here in Chicago, and it's just trickling into bookstores now. So I expect that I'll hear a lot more. In the few weeks that it's been on the book stands, I actually have gotten a whole series of calls, first from many of the social service agencies and community organizations around the city. Just yesterday, for example, I got a call from some a concerned organization, the South Austin Community Coalition on the west side of Chicago, that's been working for years to deal with this issue of the utilities costs and water and energy deprivation among the poor in Chicago, and they're very interested in looking for ways to try to mobilize a case to make this a more compelling political issue. I've gotten calls from organizations that deal with the elderly and the issue of aging alone, and I've gotten a lot of interest from public health experts and from even, I have to say, from people working in city agencies who care deeply about these kinds of issues and would like to have more resources to do it. So it'll be interesting to see the way that it goes. I think the big response that I'm waiting to get is from the city of Chicago itself, from some of the journalistic organizations, from residents of the city, because in a way the book asks them to come back and to think about this event again and to decide whether it's the kind of story that will move them to deal with these issues in some mm-hmm. different way. And the jury's still out. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, very interesting. Eric, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Eric Kleinenberg has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a sociologist. He's the author of Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. Eric Kleinenberg teaches at Northwestern University. This fall, he'll be at New York University as an assistant professor of sociology.